Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 2, delivered on August 20, 2009. The title of this lecture is The World of Finance.
Today, the world of finance. Let me clarify just briefly a few remarks from the last lecture. This is financial management, as opposed to capital markets, as opposed to investments. And I shall cabin the lectures to try to maintain the focus on the financial management aspect of finance. However, as I said the last time, there is an awful lot of spillage all over the place. And in the early lectures, I will address a number of topics that are related to all three areas of finance. I am concerned that I will have to spend a little bit of time addressing a few legal and regulatory issues before I go too far in this class. And I have to ask you, have you had a business law course of any kind yet, or a legal environment of business course? I'm getting nods and around the room. Okay, well, that gives me some comfort. I need you at least at a minimum to know about the theory of contracts. And I will probably cover it briefly because in this course we will talk about securities. And securities are a variety of contract, a type of contract. This is a contract representing a claim on cash flows. That's what a security is. And when I say the word security, I can refer to a lot of different things. A mortgage, what is commonly called a mortgage, is a security. The borrower is the seller of the security, the issuer. The buyer, the purchaser of the security, is the lender. So if you want to borrow, you have this dream of owning a double-wide trailer someday when you hit the big time. Okay, yes, indeed, a double-wide trailer with a double-wide woman. And indeed, you will want to borrow the money for that, $17,000. Well, it's $15,000, but you want to get one of those really nice skirts around it and, you know, get some landscaping done so you can put your broken cars on it and up on cinders, and they'll look, you know, they'll have that proper feng shui, you know, rusty car must point north to draw energy. Mind you, concentrate. You see, when you borrow that money, you are actually issuing a debt security. Now, what you are doing is you are also seeking a buyer for a price of $17,000. Now, oftentimes, there is a prearrangement for the loan to happen. The buyer is prearranged, a bank or a savings and loan or a credit union, some kind of lending institution. And you're saying, no, I'm not issuing, I'm not writing this contract. Well, yes, you are. You're actually going to use a prepackaged instrument that's probably been created, at least in broad form, by lawyers and then tailored to the needs of your buyer. But that instrument is literally handed to you blank form with some parts filled out. And then by you signing it, you are then posing to offer it. And then the lender, upon reviewing your credit history, then says, I accept. And for the price, you don't get that $17,000. Obviously, there's an arrangement so that the seller of the mobile home will get the money. But the price is that the buyer pays is the face value of the loan, more or less. And then from there, that lender holds the security and in holding it has a promissory note that represents a claim on cash flows of yours in the future and for a period of time. And you, by signing this, by selling this, have agreed that you shall accept that claim on cash flows, and you agree to meet the standards for the delivery of the cash flows in a timely manner. And then there are provisions in the case of default and all of that kind of stuff. But that is literally a kind of security, and it's a contract. A stock that is sold, by a share of common stock sold by a company in an offering, a primary or secondary offering, that represents, once you get that, you have a claim on the residual cash flows of the corporation. The corporation's prior claim faces prior claims from debt holders, but if there's anything left over, you have a claim on it. You don't have the right to it. And that's something the book says, right. No. It's a claim on future cash flows. So as an owner of a corporation, given that the prior claims of debt holders have been satisfied in a timely manner, your contract, that share of common stock, represents a claim you have on the residual cash flows of the corporation. And this is the way with every security. It is some kind of a contract, and the holder of the contract has a claim that is embodied in the contract, a claim on future cash flows. I shouldn't say future expected. Okay, so I begin with that, but I do want to go a little bit into detail about contracts, the four pillars of what constitutes a contract rather than a mere agreement. Would be, and I'll do this next time too. But a contract must have an offer and an acceptance. That's one. Offer and acceptance. Two, there must be mutual consideration. Thing of value for thing of value. Three, there must be capacity on the part of the parties to the contract. Capacity. And four, there must be legality. The contract must be legal. So again, offer and acceptance must be there. Mutual consideration, thing of value for thing of value. Three, capacity. The agents must be capable of entering into the contract. Four, legality. So, backing up real quick, and I don't want to get into this too much here, but backing up real quick. Legality. You go to Chicago and arrange to rent a lady of the evening. Indeed. She offers, you offer, I shall pay you the sum of $100. Okay, let's say you're Elliot Spitzer. I shall pay you the sum of $5,000. And she says, I accept. Okay, you've got to offer an acceptance. Okay, now, you give her the money, she gives you, and so you got thing of value for thing of value. Okay, so second one, capacity. Well, you're both adults. Well, she's an adult, she says she is. Okay, we got capacity, but it's not legal. So it fails as a contract. It is not a contract. It is an agreement. You might even argue that it is a quasi-contract. That's actually a legal term, quasi-contract. You might argue that, but it is not. Okay, now look at another one, a gift. Woman, I give you a gift, a diamond ring. And you take this, and then you say, and then I say, okay, now you owe me a smooch. We've got a contract, come on.
I didn't agree.
And that's exactly right. It was not a specific thing of value for thing of value. So when you take that young lady that you're going out with bowling, don't expect anything for it. Dude, I know it's a big thing for you, bowling, hey, pizza, but it's not a contract, not enforceable as a contract. Okay, and she accepted the bowling. She was more than happy to. She said, yeah, let's go, pin boy. And but it doesn't work as a contract, you see. So, and understand this. Now, one last thing before I go on. Let's take an advertisement at McDonald's. Clearly, there is a contract involved. No doubt about that. It's an oral contract. Matter of fact, people think contracts are written. Matter of fact, truth of the matter is, the vast majority of contracts into which you will enter in your life are oral contracts, not written contracts. Oral contracts are perfectly valid, perfectly good, and quite efficient. But now you go into McDonald's, and who looks like a McDonald's? You look like a McDonald's. I come up to the counter, and you say, "May I McHelp you, McPlease?" I said, "Dude, weren't you in my finance class?" "Yes." And I said, "Well, why are you here?" "Because this is the only job I can get. I've got a major in finance." Okay, that's harsh, hurtful. Okay, you say, "What would you McLike?" And I'd say, "Well, I would McLike a McDouble cheeseburger." And you say, "Okay." And that's $2.50. And so I pull out the $2.50 and I give it to you. And you give me my cheeseburger. Okay. Who made the offer and who accepted? Where was the offer? Where was the acceptance? Who was the offeror and who was the offeree? Who was the offerer? In fact, I was. He can't offer. In fact, watch that. And I have to bring that up. See, and this is what worries me about the way business law is taught. I practice law without a license. I teach business law. He is not the offerer. I am the offerer. Because you say, "Well, wait a minute, he had a sign up there." That's right. But he didn't have the specifics. He didn't say, "This many is what you will buy at this price at this time." He didn't have enough specificity to make an offer. I made the offer. And then he accepted the offer by giving me a price. That was his acceptance. It's like in an auction. Let me try an auction. Who look? Okay, I am going to offer this fine, upstanding young Christian stud, and I'd like to hear an opening bid of $50. And we look around, you say, "All right, $50. Now, what happened there? Did you offer or did I offer $50? You did. You offered $50. I have $50. Do I hear $75? $75. $75. You say $75. You're going to make him into a man slave for over in the Arab world. Okay? I don't know. You've just counteroffered. Well, actually, did he counteroffer or did I counteroffer? Oh, yeah. Now, that kills your offer. 75, 75, 75. And then you say 100, 100, 100. Going once, going twice, and I hit the gavel. You've made the offer. When I hit the gavel, I accept. Okay? eBay. When you're bidding, you're the offeror. The person who put up is just soliciting offers. Bring me an offer. My starting bid is... That's just bring me an offer. It's a solicitation for an offer. It is not an offer. The offer comes with the bid, and then a higher bid kills the earlier bid, and then at the end, at the closing bell, the offer that is the highest is the one by the contract with eBay that is accepted. Okay? So I want to make sure that you know that, because this will come into play later in the course when we're talking about securities. Who's offering? Who's selling? Who's the offeror? Who's the offeree? What constitutes a valid offer? What constitutes a solicitation for an offer? Because that will come into play a little later in the course. For right now, though, let me go into some managerial, just some managerial details, managerial finance details. Some of you will go into finance. I see it right there, your declared major. Others of you are on the fence, and of course, once you have lived through this course, you will say, "Geez, I love this subject, and I want to be in it." Others of you want to stay light years away from finance as your major, and I understand that fully. However, even if you do not major in finance, and I say this to all business students, you must act and operate within an organization that has disparate parts. The different operating divisions have their own ways and their own thinking. You might be in marketing, but you must appreciate the ways of finance. You might be in human resources. But if you do not know how to bow properly to the accountants as they walk by and bless people and send people to hell, you are dead. We must understand all of the parts and the thinking and the methods. Especially, this is true, and I say this when I teach marketing classes. Look, you're going to have all the great ideas. You're going to be the people who create the products that make this company live, that are the germination of future expected cash flows. You get nowhere if you approach finance people with this burly, I know what's best for this company, here's my great idea, figure out how to do it, figure out how to make it work. You have to know how we think, how we operate, what our objectives are within our division, and how those relate to the goal of the company. First of all, first and foremost, the goal of any company, there is one and only one goal: maximize the wealth of the owners. Now, the companies we will talk about, primarily I'll focus in this course on public companies. Public. That means companies that issue stock and they answer to the shareholders, okay? So I would say maximize the wealth of the shareholders in the more specific context of a public company, a stock-based public company. Maximize the wealth of the owners. That's your goal. There is no other goal of the firm. Anything else we say is either as some intermediate objective or it's bullshit. We can go out there all day and have mission statements. Our goal is to make the world better and to make our customers happy and to make butterflies fly around all the children of the world. No, no, no. Because if you screw your owners, your owners will fire your ass if you still have a company. Everything else is secondary to the maximization of the wealth of the shareholders. You have to satisfy them first and foremost and always. If you don't, your company will not survive, or at least you won't, because your owners will replace you. Now you're saying to yourself, "Now that's awfully harsh." And the reality is that there is a deep, I have to talk the hard capitalist line, okay? This is hardcore capital. The reality is that our way of capitalism has developed, and it's always been there to some extent, but it's really developed a bad defect in the sense that we're not maximizing the wealth of the shareholders. I mean, when you've got CEOs who screw up year over year over year and we just keep giving them these damn big bonuses and all that, that's not capitalism. That's not pure capitalism. You're not maximizing the wealth of the owners by keeping idiots on board, keeping incompetence, keeping failures. But they are there. You can look right all around you and see these CEOs who are screwing the pooch. And they just keep, that's a technical term. And they just keep getting these big bonuses and these big paychecks for screwing up over and over again. And there's, of course, a rebellion going on. But the problem is the shareholders, the ones who really, really should be the power to crack down on this nonsense, aren't doing it. Why aren't they doing it? Because essentially they are separated from the process of the control of the company so much that they just aren't there to deal with it. They can't fire the people. They can't punish the people. This goes to the heart of the assignment I'm going to give you this weekend, reading about the agency dilemma. The agency problem can be the wedge that separates the operating organization, corporation, from the pure goal of maximization of the wealth of the owners. It really can and probably is what is at the heart of why we are not doing it in the pure way, why we're not maximizing wealth of the shareholders in a lot of companies these days. Now, let me do something here. See that word wealth? That is not the same as profit. Okay? The profitability of a corporation is important. Here's a rule. It's better to make a profit than a loss. It's kind of a subtle rule, but it's one. You're in a finance class, so I can talk to you on this complicated level. Yes, we do have to be profitable, but profitability of the corporation is only loosely related to value of the corporation. Profitability of the corporation is only loosely related to value of the corporation. And the value of the corporation is what drives the wealth of the owners. And again, profitability of a corporation is only loosely related to value of the corporation. And it is the value, not the profitability, but the value of the corporation that determines or defines the wealth of the owners. I can have a corporation. And this goes back to what I was talking about in our last lecture about opportunity costs. And I'll tell you right now, it happens all the time. A company posts a profit of $16 million and its stock price tumbles on the announcement. Well, that's obviously irrationality. Markets are not irrational. There's a reason why that happened. And I don't expect you to answer it. If you do answer it, I'll give you a cookie. But answer it right. Madam, why would the stock price tumble when the corporation announced that it had made $16 million in profit? Well, that's okay. Let's try it this way. You get your degree from Illinois State University, and you get your degree in finance, and you go out there, and I'm at the graduation, and I give you a slap on the back, damn good job, and you go away, and I see you. 2 years later, you come rushing up to me on December the 31st, and you of a year, a couple of years after, Professor, you will be so proud of me. I started my own coffee shop here in town, and I made a profit last year. I actually didn't just break even. I made a profit. The accountants told me I made a profit of $18,000 last year. That's $18,000 for me. And so what do you think of me? You know what I'm going to say? You dumbass. Burn the building to the ground, walk away, join a hippie commune. What? I made a profit. Didn't you say profit? No, I didn't. I said value, not profit. What's wrong with the fact that he made a profit of $18,000 last year? What's wrong with that? Yes? Oh, well, he didn't make. He's a graduate of Illinois State University. He had me as his professor. He should make at least $60,000 a year working at State Barn. You made $18,000. You lost. What the hell? $42,000. You lost $42,000. Because your $60,000 that you could have earned in your best alternative, you gathered only 18 of that, so you have a cost, unrewarded, of $42,000. So now, when that company makes a profit of $16 million and its stock price collapses, what that means is that the financial markets are saying, you idiots, you should have made a lot more than that based upon the risk we took with your stock. And now we're going to sell your stock because you did not make as much as you should have. We can invest in other securities with commensurate risk and make a better return. So we're going to drop your stock. We're going to sell off until the price of it goes low enough that it's worth having a stock that makes only where the company makes only $16 million a year in profit. That's how the thinking works in the financial markets. It's not based on profit. It's based, first of all, on what you should earn. What you should earn. Not what you do earn, what you should earn. Your shareholders have literally millions of alternatives to your corporation, if you do not deliver a sufficient return on investment for the risk that they're taking with you, they are going to kick your ass. I was in the markets. I was a broker. I ran a penny stock. I know, for one day I did. But you see this all the time. Companies post profits and their stock price collapses, drops. And it's simply, and also, interestingly enough, sometimes you can see a company post a loss and its stock price will go up. Now, why would that be? Well, because the investors might have expected a worse loss. And so once you post that you didn't do such a bad job, then they will buy in. Also, it has nothing to do with what's already happened anyway. Really, what they'll be investing in is what your potential is. Right now, madam, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but I think you're worth about $150. That would be the what I, you know, if I dried you out, ground you up, and separated the different ingredients, I could probably make $150, you know, at a health food store, you know, something like that. But that's not what your value is, really. It's what you're going to make down the road. You guys are worth millions of dollars, really, because that's the expected value of your future expected. That's the value of your future expected cash flows. It's not what you're worth now. It's what you're going to make in money down the road. It's about potential, not about where we are. So oftentimes you will see, especially in boom times where there is a willingness to take risk by investors, companies can make a loss and the investors will still line up. Hell, that was what I specialized in. Companies that were basically just barely starting, their losses were massive. But people were still buying the stock, buying it in droves in some cases, because there was an expectation that the company would do better down the road. There is an expectation. As I mentioned on occasion, there is a great desire of a parent to kill a teenage child. It really, really, I've thought about it. I planned it out, you know, worked out the details, gotten the shovel, and I had my 5 acres and all that kind of stuff, and worked out explaining how the kid just took off and I haven't seen him. But I also know that it's not the value of the person there, it's the value of that person looking down the road and seeing, well, this person's going to make lots of money and take care of me in my old age, and you know, he'll be the one who rehooks my tubes back up when they fall out and I start feeling a trickle down my butt. He'll be the one who hooks them back in and all that. You see, it's the potential. It's not the actual right now. Now, let me get here to this point about the value. Value is based upon cash flows. Value is based upon cash flows. Value, I'm not going to go so far here, right now, as saying value is cash flow. But value is related to cash flow. Now, there is cash flow in and there is cash flow out. The ideal is to have the cash flow in be higher than the cash flow out. Now, cash flow in comes from several different sources. You can access capital markets for cash flow. Sell stock, sell bonds, borrow money, working capital money. You can pull money in through those mechanisms. And in the early chapters of the book, you see the emphasis being on that source of cash. Okay? And I'm talking about cash. I'm not talking about revenue. I'm not talking about accounting revenue. Because revenue can be in terms of receivables. Okay? Not everyone who buys from a company is paying cash money up front. What I'm talking about is actual physical cash money at any given time. So that can come from sales, if they're cash sales. It can come from receivables that are coming due and are satisfied. Those are two primary vehicles. But interestingly enough, you see, the problem is the book, in the early chapters, and I do understand why they're doing it, they focus on the money that comes in externally from sales of stock, sales of bonds, short borrowings and all that kind of stuff, through working capital management funds, through commercial paper and all that. Well, that's fine, but the reality of it is that sooner or later, you cannot live on borrowing and selling stock. Sooner or later, you have to generate internal equity. In other words, you have to have a product to sell, and you have to, sooner or later, live on what you are earning, not on selling more stock, borrowing more money. So I want to emphasize that, because it does seem like the book does kind of focus on, well, we can bring in money to the corporation through selling stock, we can bring in money through selling bonds, and through these financial intermediaries, the company gets its cash flows in. And that's fine, except that for the long haul to be a going concern, the company has to be able to pull in money through the sales of its products, be they goods or services. Cash flow in. Cash flow out, of course, is you're paying your bills, taking care of your short-term bills, taking care of your long-term bills. However, here is the thing about that, too. It's not exactly the bills that are the cash outflow. It's the bills you pay. So if you're paying for a bill right up front, that's a cash outflow. If you're satisfying an account payable, that's a cash outflow. But just saying, well, I've got a bill, you incurred it, but you have, the bill has occurred, but you have not incurred the expense. It is only with the incurrence that you have a cash outflow. Have any of you ever waited to pay a bill, or do you pay your bills the day they come in the mail? Do you ever wait? Have you ever waited? You have? Okay. So the, mind you, woman, you see what happened there? That was not a cash outflow for you. Just because you incurred, just because the bill showed up, I'll avoid incur and occur for now, but just because the bill showed up, that's not a cash outflow. It's if you pay it, when and if you pay it, that it is truly a cash outflow. So when we look at accounting, especially when we look at revenues and costs, that's not what a financial analyst would care about to determine value. That's what not what the stock markets really care about when they assess the value of a corporation and then divide that up by the number of shares of stock. What they are looking for is the cash flow pattern. Is more cash flowing in than flowing out? Can we expect this to continue? How high is our certainty that this will continue? Those are what drives value. Not accounting profit, not revenue, not accounting costs. It's cash flows. And that brings us to the next point. Cash flow. There are three aspects to any cash flow that you will see coming in a corporation. First of all, is the level of the cash flow. That's the size, what the book calls size. Level of cash flow. Here's a rule. A bigger cash inflow is better than a smaller cash inflow. Okay? That's a little complicated, but you know, it seems a little reasonable. Level. How big is the cash flow? How big is the cash flow in? How big is the cash flow out? Okay? The next is the one that we talk about a lot in this class. Timing. Madam, I'm going to give you $1,000. Which would you like? Would you like that $1,000 today, or would you like it in 10 years?
Today.
What? Are you one of those instant gratification kind of people? Yes, you are, obviously. Look, in economics, remember that more is preferred to less? Well, now is preferred to later as well. That's the other side of it. Sooner's preferred to later. That's just the way it is, okay? You can have something to eat in a year, or you can have something to eat tonight. Which do you want? Oh, yeah. I mean, that's it. So the timing. You know, we could have a corporation that's going to just bust out all over the place, big money coming in 10 years, but that's not too impressive right now. So the timing matters. When the cash flow is occurring. And the last one, which is the other thing in this course we really look at a lot, is risk. Risk of the cash flow. The greater the risk, the lower the value. Here's an interesting thing. Well, let's see. Risk is so fundamental. I shall give you a dollar if you will stand on the train track down there at the edge of campus and not move for 24 hours. Okay, fine. I'll show you the money. A dollar. What are you, some kind of socialist? That dollar is not worth the aggravation. Because there is a good probability in that 24 hours that a train's going to go by, man, ding, 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 ding. And we'll be cleaning you up off the track with a spatula. You see, it's not worth the aggravation. There has to be a good enough reward. Now, if there's a lot of risk in a company, it could have a lot of potential. But if there's a lot of risk involved, you aren't going to pay a whole lot for that stock. That's what the NASDAQ is all about, is these small, very risky companies, and the stock is cheap. It's penny stock in a lot of cases. It's nearly penny stock. And it's not because that's the blue light special section of the Wall Street Journal. It's because the cash flows that could arise from a company like that are extraordinarily risky. So even though there is a great expected return, that is associated. The only way you get a great expected return is if you start with a low value and go from there. Have any of you ever seen, people are rational. Now, I qualify that the rationality is bounded by the information they have, by the resources available to them other than information. But you are not one of the first principles of finance. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. This is intimately related, therefore, to lower value now. To lower value now. You can buy very safe instruments that are very expensive. You are not expecting a huge return on those. You buy cheap because you are expecting a big return on it. You buy cheap because you're expecting a big return on it. Now, people are rational in their risk assessment. You do take risks because you expect something out of it. You don't bear a risk for no reason. And no market is going to reward you for bearing a risk for no reason. Have any of you ever heard of the Darwin Awards? They are the awards given every year to people who have done humanity the greatest favor by getting themselves killed so they don't propagate their stupid genes. Now, in any given year, you will see people, you think these people are so stupid, they should not have been even allowed to breed. Fortunately, they died. That's why they got the Darwin Award. So they're not going to breed and make more of their kind. And you say, well, they're just crazy. That's irrational. No. In most cases, first of all, they did not assess the risk properly. Why didn't they assess the risk properly? It's simply because they didn't have enough information to assess the risk properly. In other cases, however, they were fully cognizant that there was a very high risk involved in what they were doing. That's why they did it, because they expected an extraordinary return in terms of maybe a bet that was placed on what they were doing, or in terms of just the cred that they'd get from doing what they did. Now, let me try this. Have any of you been to Vegas in recent years? Any? Did you, by any chance, see those the amusement ride up at the top of the skyscraper? There's a ride up at the top of this one. And that's the one that comes out with the arm. And it, after you get on it, it hangs you out. Your ass is looking down way too many stories. And you're spinning around in free space. And now, that's an extraordinarily risky thing to do. So the only people who would do that are either people who are totally stupid, or people who expect an extraordinary return for the investment of their time and their ass. Have any of you ever been down to Florida to Disney World? You know, tried the Tower of Terror? Never again. If you haven't, they take you up in an elevator in total darkness. You don't know how far you're going up. And then suddenly, the doors open. You know what I saw when the doors opened? I saw the curvature of the earth. And I swear to God, I saw Jesus. And then they shut the doors and they started dropping. And every now and then you'd pass these places where these doors would open and you'd see the earth flying by, dead relatives smiling at you, you know, and all that. And then the ultimate insult, when they let you off and you're walking out there, they've been taking pictures of you on the way down. You know, my chops were up here. I now know the risk. I will not do that again, ever in my life. Now, let me try this. Have you ever, sir, broken the speed limit? Mm-hmm. You have? Yeah, actually, I know. I saw you drive like a blind trout. Now, why did you do that? Because you get to your destination sooner. Besides, there's the thrill of scaring small children trying to get out of your way, you know, and all that. But you're getting to your destination. You expect a return, and you're willing to bear the risk of a police officer catching you. There's no morals involved in avoiding an accident. It's all about the risk that you're willing to take for the return you expect from it. Now, would you speed if there were a line of police cars just parked along the side and the police officers were munching on donuts? No, you wouldn't, because the risk would be way too high for any benefits that you would get from driving by them and giving them the finger. Okay? You see, we bear risk to get an expected return. That's not the same as getting the return, it's but that we expect a higher return. This is hugely important in finance. To get a higher return, to expect a higher return, you have to bear more risk. But the bearing of risk by a corporation lowers its value. The bearing of risk by a corporation lowers its value because future cash flows, the expectation of future cash flows is less certain. So you could tell me two corporations, one sure thing, $100,000 in 5 years, the other one maybe $100,000 in 5 years. I want to place a higher value on your corporation than I am on yours. Well, it's the same amount of money in 5 years. Timing is the same. Level is the same. But the risk is different. Therefore, I will value your corporation higher than yours. Okay? Now, here's the interesting thing about risk, though. And it cuts both ways. The book talks about one way, and let me address the balance of the two ways. In the business world, there is a herd mentality. There has to be. You have to play the herd game. You can't be like me and just walk in and act like you're Jesus and put down a lake and try to walk across it. You can't do that. You have to play the herd. Now, the herd actually generally will be more risk-averse than would the individual. Interestingly enough, and the book talks about, mentions this, it's an interesting phenomenon, that shareholders, at least in some cases, would prefer to have the management take more risks than the managers as a herd are willing to take. Because, you see, you, if your risk doesn't pan out, that you're afraid for your job. You have an incentive to avoid taking on the kind of risk that might get you kicked in the butt by the shareholders. Even though the shareholders would say, you turned down that project? Why did you turn down that project? Because it was risky. If it would have failed, you would have fired. I would have been fired. So interestingly enough, there's a disintermediation that can happen between the preferences for risk of the shareholders and the risk acceptance of the herd. On the other hand, you can also see it the other way too. Some herds are just damn perverse. They will take on too much risk simply because there is a disintermediation between responsibility and accountability with these kinds, with some management. Look at some of these companies that have failed. They failed because they took on stupid risks, terrible risks, risks that the shareholders would have had passed out if they had seen just how risky it was. Risks that if the shareholders had been better informed would have had a fit about. A great example of this is in the banking sector. One of the biggest problems that was building up in the banking sector was the depletion of Tier 1 capital. Banks were just not having as much of it. That's a very risky thing to do. Tier 1 capital is the capital that's safe that you use for safe investments. These banks were contracting their Tier 1 capital. It was just closing down. Part of that was the Federal Reserve was clamping down on M1, the money supply M1, so the banks just didn't have that kind of Tier 1 capital. But if investors, common normal investors, had grasped just how risky running without much Tier 1 capital was, there would have been a lot of screaming from shareholders that might have been listened to. But the herd mentality was, let's take the risk, let's take the risk, let's take the risk. Because there was no accountability. The shareholders weren't screaming. Here. I mentioned briefly that in this course, we will talk about the owners being shareholders. The owners being shareholders. There are essentially three kinds of business entities, and I would be remiss if I would not bring them up. The book actually brings up a fourth kind of business entity, but really, that's a hybrid. The first business entity is the sole proprietor. The one-person show. A sole proprietorship is a business entity where one owner bears all of the risk personally and has absolute, undivided claim to the residual cash flows. Bears all of the risk personally and has absolute undivided claim to the residual cash flows. And many of you have been sole proprietors. I am a sole proprietor in some of my businesses. If you have ever mowed a lawn for money, you were a sole proprietor. If you ever done babysitting, you were a sole proprietor. And if you have ever made money that was just you doing something, you were a sole proprietor. You have absolute risk. So if you're mowing a lawn and you run over the client's poodle, that's your ass. I mean, it's the poodle's ass, obviously, but you know, you give that dog a show dog trim. But you know, you're going along, yeah, they. Well, they're going to sue you. You are going to pay. It will be your stuff that goes. But on the other hand, once you have mowed that lawn, provided that nothing went wrong, that person gives you $20, and you have that money. You take out, well, you know, you've obviously paid some for the gasoline, and you have to pay whatever it is you borrowed for the mower. But whatever is left is yours. You don't have to share it with anybody. You can go, indeed, to Denny's and get a grand slam. Is life good or what? The second kind is a partnership. Now, there are all manner of partnerships. And if you were in my legal environment of business class, I'd go into all of the different varieties. But in general, a partnership is an agreement where more than one person accepts all of the risk for the claim, absolute claim, divided between them on the residual cash flow. Where more than one person accepts the risk, usually jointly and severally, and in return gets the absolute divided claim on the cash flows. That's how it works. Now, there, like I said, there are all kinds of these. There's a general partnership, which meets that right on the button. But then you've got these limited partnerships, where in a limited partnership, there are general partners. They get the lion's share. They take the risk. The limited partners, their risk is limited only to their investment. In other words, if there's a lawsuit, they're not hit with that. If the company takes in more bills than it gets in money and it goes tap city, the limited partners, they would not have anything go after, no one would go after their assets. The general partners in one of these limited partnerships, they're the ones who take the risk that they could get hit personally. And in exchange for that, they get the lion's share of the money. I actually designed limited partnerships for low-income housing for the elderly. Some years ago, there was a government program for real low-interest loans. What we would do is we would set up limited partnerships and then sell units of the limited partnership to wealthy people. And like, for example, $20,000 to maybe 40 of these for $20,000 each, and to limited partners. We were the general partners. We would get any big money that came in. But the limited partners were given a certain guarantee that if there was money to be made off these investments, they would get some of that money. Here's the problem. Here's an interesting thing, though. Almost always these limited partnerships lost lots of money. Lots. And our investors, our limited partners, were just thrilled. They loved them. They'd line up for more of them. You say, why? Why? Oh, because not only were they in line to get a share of any money we made, they were also in line to get a share of losses that were incurred. So their whole point was these were loss vehicles. They put in $20,000, they get loss on depreciation, they get loss other ways. We tell them if you've got a loss, they write that off against their ordinary income. So it's not always about profit, definitely, that drives value. In this case, the value, profit wasn't there. Value was very high because the value was in the tax shields we were creating for our limited partners. And, of course, we were paying ourselves a salary, too, so we made money off them, too. So there's a great example where profit has nothing to do with the value. Look, here's the one that we're going to deal with in this class, the corporation. In partnerships and sole proprietorships, all risk is borne by the owners. All risk. Not just the investment. Unlimited risk. You run over that poodle, they can go through your mower, they can go through that truck of yours, they can go through all of your assets and take you to the cleaners. Because you have no protection. You might have insurance. You're stupid if you don't BOP. BOP is a business owner's policy. But, I mean, they can just go right at you. There's no protection. You are the show. Partnership, sole proprietorship. A corporation is a different animal. A corporation exists under state law, not under federal law, under state law. You incorporate at the state level. Once you have incorporated, the state and therefore the federal government recognizes that corporation as a separate entity. It is not the owners. The stock that you sell, which represents ownership of the corporation, claims on residual cash flow, those owners All they can ever lose is their investment. If the bills pile up out the wazoo, the worst that can happen is that the creditors can take the assets of the corporation. They cannot pierce the corporate veil. A court would be very reticent. It is a high, high standard, thank God, in some cases of my own. The courts, no. Creditors, you can have whatever the corporation, you know, you can take away the tables, you can take away the computers, you can take away their bank accounts, but you can't have anything of the owners. The owners are the shareholders. They're protected. There's a veil. There's a veil between the owners and the liabilities of the corporation. That is the beauty of the corporate form of organization. It allows us as owners to take considerably more risk than we would if our assets were, our personal ass and assets were on the line. You see, this is what makes a corporation so special. And interestingly enough, I don't know how far they go into this in accounting, but did you ever see that thing, the assets equal the liabilities plus the owner's equity? You remember that fundamental equation of accounting? In legal terms, in finance, that has a physical meaning. Look at the wall made by that plus sign. That's a wall that protects the owners from the liabilities of the corporation. That's a veil. So that as owners, we can take risks that no proprietor in his right mind would take, no partnership in his right mind would take. Because the worst that can happen is that the creditors can hit the corporation because it is the corporation borrowing the money. It is not us. In your lawnmower business, you put that lawnmower on your credit card. You did. In a corporation, the corporation would be putting that lawnmower on the credit card. And therefore, if the credit card isn't satisfied, the lending institution can go no further than the corporation. If it's you, they can go through whatever you have. They can take that lawnmower. If that's not the full value, if they can't liquidate that for enough, they'll just go after other stuff of yours. You see? They'll attach whatever they want. But there is that wall of separation that protects the owners. Now, there's a price for that, though. There's a price for that. And unfortunately, here's another one of those places where the line of pure capitalism has been blurred. Technically, ownership must be separate from management of a corporation. The owners are supposed to stay out of the management of the corporation. They are the investors, and then they bring professionals in who manage the corporation. But that's not, unfortunately, how it oftentimes works. But that's how it should work. That's how it ought to work. There are problems with that. The agency dilemma plays in very badly there. I consulted for these small companies. They'd sold stock to people who had no business being investing in high-risk small companies, small caps. These shareholders would be calling and coming in all the time. Well, let me see what you're doing here. I think I got a couple of ideas about how. Literally, get out of here. You're an owner. I paid for this. I invested in it. That's right. You get your ass out. But they wouldn't. They didn't understand. You are not allowed here. You are the investors. You put the money down and you shut up. And unfortunately, that's not even understood by some fairly sophisticated investors. How do you manage the corporation as an owner? What do you do if you're not allowed to participate in management? What are you supposed to do then? Come on, what would you do? If you can't manage a corporation, you're an owner, you're a stockholder, what are you supposed to do if the company is screwing the pooch? Yes. You punish them by selling. Eventually, that phone call from Clueville, they'll answer it because the stock price goes down, down, down the ring of fire. Well, you're saying, well, I've had company management. Well, who cares if the stock price falls? Well, we will as soon as we want to try to sell some more stock to raise some more equity capital. We will. So we damn well better keep those investors happy. Because if we don't keep those investors happy with decent cash flows, level, timing, risk, then they will sell off on us. They will vote with their dollars. That's how capitalism works. Vote with the dollars. If you as an owner don't like the management of a corporation, don't bitch, sell. If you do like the management of a corporation, buy more of the stock. That's how we do it in a capitalist system, is we vote, we reward, we punish with our money. That's what the word capital is all about in capitalism. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.